Welcome to a series of podcasts from the Vegan Information Project. In each podcast, we'll be exploring in greater depth many of the issues that arose during the workshops facilitated by Tina Cubley towards the end of the VIP mini course on social movements. Okay, here we are then in the park, so please excuse any wind noises you might hear. This is Tina Cubley and Zami the Greyhound and me, Roger Yates, and we're moving into the third theme, which emerged from the end series of the VIP mini course. So we're looking at media. So quite a lot came up in the workshop itself, which we're going to go through one by one with you, Tina. But first of all, just wonder whether you could give us just a brief outline, you know, the first taste really of the anarchist view on media itself.
Sure. Well, I think the anarchist view of mass media versus independent media is something I was trying to get across to the group with the presentation I prepared for our independent media workshop, which is that mass media is inherently oppressive in that it inevitably involves a stealing of perspectives, a translation of voices. Thus, it is intrinsically violent and harmful in that it is defining the subjective experience of others. Ultimately, mass media is inevitably highly biased and slanted in favour of corporations, governments, authority. The mass media represents authority. It speaks for authority.
And you used the phrase corporate media to emphasise that, didn't you?
That's right, yeah. I actually prefer that to mass media because it does underline that what we're dealing with here is essentially a propaganda machine. You know, it's just like, if you think about, in reality, how long would a journalist dealing with working through corporate media who puts ethics before profit, how long would somebody like that be able to stand by their principles? How long could they survive in that environment? I think it's completely unrealistic to suppose that corporate media can ever be unbiased. I mean, this leads into what we dealt with in the workshop, which is that there is no view from nowhere. And of course, the anarchist take on that is that there shouldn't be. There can't be. Everybody is speaking for somebody. Who is the corporate media speaking for? As I've just explained, the authorities. And of course, the anarchist answer to that is a independent network of autonomous media collectives, which don't take away somebody's viewpoint. Basically, independent media is taking back the right to speak for ourselves, refusing to allow people to speak for us, define what our experience is, what we need, what we want. I mean, again, this is an issue that Marcuse has a lot to say about, you know, the whole false needs thing. We're bombarded by corporate media's definitions of our lives, basically. Corporate media is like the PR officer for authority, you know? It sells us the system we live under. Independent media is the opposite of that. Independent media is intrinsically revolutionary. It changes everything to be able to speak for yourself.
What do you think then of the you know, the kind of maverick journalists or the kind of investigative journalists? And I mean, is your opinion of them a little bit like a halfway house, a little bit like a fair trade type thing? In other words, they're kind of part of the, you know, of the intrinsically bad thing, and yet they're trying to take an independent role.
Yeah, pretty much. That's actually a very good analogy. I do see it as being a fair trade thing, ultimately, because
they're limited in their radicalism.
Yes. That is not to say, of course, that their aspirations are insincere, that their principles are not real and honest. I'm not making those claims at all, because I know plenty of people working within the system who are trying desperately to work against the system to change it. And that, of course, is where, as an anarchist, I depart from sympathy with them, because I just think the system's gone beyond changing. The system is rotten to the core, and we can't have a situation where we can reform the corporate media and make it speak for us. We can't clamour to get into the corporate media, be represented in the corporate media, because they will never tell the truth about us or for us. It is not in their interest to do so. And also, it's against anarchist principles to rely on or ask anybody else to tell the truth for us.
You know, so I suppose a good analogy for people in the animal advocacy movement would be the idea of asking a politician rather than doing yourself.
Yeah, absolutely, because I just think, again, a point I made in the workshop, so I'm kind of quoting myself yet again, but what value does anything that gets into corporate media really have? Because if you think about any representation of corporate media that litters our lives at present, what value does something that maybe has a warped, highly inaccurate, but with a few good lines in it, report about it at demo, what value does that have alongside a McDonald's advertisement? Or a sexist clothing advertisement, as nearly all clothing advertisements are, or so on. All these representations of violence. Then you get one thing that maybe wasn't too awful. And you just think, what kind of a victory is that? Let's ask for what we want for a change.
Yeah, and the one thing that stands out for me there in what you just said is the one thing, because it would be an isolated one thing, whereas the McDonald's adverts are there all the time, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. And we're spending a hell of a lot of time and energy trying to get into the corporate media, trying to get our viewpoint across. And what's the problem there is, again, I'd return to Marcuse to define what the problem is there, is that we are unable to conceive of a way to contact our fellow citizens without having to kind of be misrepresented in the media and sold back to them as something else, someone else, you know? It's just kind of, we rely on to adapt to the sexist phrase, middle person, to convey our viewpoints to them. I'm just thinking, you can go to people and speak to them. Why are we so desperate to get translated by corporate media and sold back in a more socially acceptable format? Revolution cannot be made socially acceptable. It can't be done. And I just think we are unable to imagine what a world, a form of communication made up of autonomous, independent media cells would look like. Everybody speaks for themselves. There is no misrepresentation. There is no translation. It's just, that would be the definition of revolutionary communication. Yes, I think at heart, most of us believe that to be impossible. And that is why we settle for this kind of...
Even if possible... smaller, so we come back to the mass thing. I mean, it's the one point that I made, because I did a media thing earlier in the course from a sociological point of view, and it's the mass part of mass media which is seductive, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Kind of have thousands of millions of people read your words or whatever. What people miss with that is that your words are very unlikely to get into corporate media anyway, at least not
untranslated.
Yes, untranslated, not quoted out of context, not made to illustrate the point of view that the corporate media holds about you and is thus trying to sell to the public to defuse you as a threat to the system, you know? That is in corporate media's interests. It's just, I think it's really naive to imagine that the corporate media will do something fair instead of something profitable. Or something true instead of something that sells.
Yes, and that thing about if it bleeds, it leads, and so they're always looking for sensation, aren't they? And that.
Yeah, absolutely. Which, of course, from a feminist perspective, is also very damaging and violent. In that, it kind of, I don't know, corporate media makes patriarchy disappear. precisely because of its sensationalisation of violence against women. And the same, obviously, hard to express what I mean here, but I don't know, obviously corporate media thrives on violence, and yet what we get through corporate media is complete distortion. Because where do we see violence as violence actually is? As I've just pointed out, we see it in McDonald's advertisements, we see it in advertisements for high heels, we see it everywhere, but it's disguised. You know, violence, as we know it to be, as we experience it, is sold to us as something seductive, something we have to have, you know? And, you know, it's kind of, it's all twisted. This is what corporate media does to definitions. That's what corporate media does to truth, ultimately.
Yeah, actually, that point reminds me of something. If you remember the last VIP gazebo stall, there was an anthropologist who came up, and she was saying that, you know, people don't walk through the door of McDonald's saying, I'm going to be violent now.
Exactly. But that's something which corporate media has to accept a lot of responsibility for as well, because, as I've pointed out, a violent world built on harm is sold to us and kind of glossed over to us as something that's entirely desirable. And if, in certain small unimportant aspects, it's undesirable, it is at least necessary. I think this is what we have to keep questioning. Again, the anarchist ideal of question everything. If we want a free world, which of course, as an anarchist, I'm going to say would be an anarchist world, then we need to start thinking with creativity and dedication about representing ourselves, about getting our voices back, because corporate media is not interested in our voices. It wants to sell us as some kind of caricature or sensation, so I just don't see what use such a compromise as interaction with corporate media can be to a social justice movement. I don't see it.
Okay, so we'll move on to the issue then that you raised, which was about the anarchist alternative is the independent media.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think people at the workshop, they kind of wanted to know what that would look like and, you know, how it would operate in a way, didn't they?
Yeah, there was a lot of problems. Of course, I'll come back, actually, to the issue that it was kind of revealing in this workshop, in the sense that I was proven not to be an evil dictator, because not that there's ever been serious rumours to that effect.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, started by you, incidentally, but the view of the group was overwhelmingly against my anarchist take on corporate media, in that they felt that as social justice activists, we can use corporate media.
Yeah, there must surely be a way.
Yeah, kind of. What it was wasn't really defined very concretely, but it was felt that wary, somewhat cynical interaction with corporate media in order to reach the people on the other side was desirable and possible. I'm questioning whether it's possible, but I'm certainly questioning whether it's desirable, because
When you say people on the other side, you mean the people that the alternative media wouldn't be able to get to, is it? Is that what it is?
Yeah, kind of. The social construct of the public.
Hmm.
We have this construct in our heads that we can't talk to people without the corporate media, you know? It's kind of the public. We forget we're the public. Everybody's the public. Yeah, it's just
They're our kind of megaphone.
Yeah, well, corporate media is designed to keep us apart from each other. Independent media is designed to link us together. And if you're asking what it would look like in practice, I think a great example was the Riot Girl movement, you know, which I pointed out to you. For all those listening, it's one of those inadequately reclaimed words that you can't tell on a podcast that girl is spelt with three R's instead of IR in the middle. I wouldn't use girl in the original sense, but yeah, the Riot Girl movement was possibly, in my view anyway, the strongest, most creative, most determined, prolonged effort to reclaim our voices, to express yourself in an uncompromising, real way, straight to one another, to create lines of communication outside the system and directly threatening to the system that there's ever been. You know, I think it's not hard to imagine, really, what independent media would look like, I don't think. I mean, I'm trying to get back into zine writing, as you know, and we're doing this podcast. Mm-hmm. We're thinking about a radio show. So, I mean, you have pirate radio. You have everything from graffiti art to zine making and distribution.
Actually, it's quite surprising, really, that groups have not really done this, because now we've got the internet, which is like a... We can communicate globally now for the first time ever. Instant global communication. And yet, when you think about it, we're not really using it very well, are we?
Again, I sound very cynical saying this, but I think the way we're using the media is disastrous, really. It's, as you just pointed out, it's an opportunity. It's a vast missed opportunity, I think. I mean, having said that, the way I used media in the past was lamentable. You know, I did a few interviews and minor things for corporate media before my resolve simply not to interact with the authorities.
You were a famous DJ once, weren't you, when you interviewed me at Trinity College in Dublin.
Yeah,
in Dublin.
That's right. I'll never forget that as a David Bowie record being suddenly switched off.
By you, by me.
But anyway, yeah, my days as a famous DJ are thankfully over. But we're not using the possibilities presented by technology very well at all. Yet again, I cannot resist saying that Marcuse would have pointed this out to us as well, that the machinery of civilization is not intrinsically oppressive. It is being used by the forces of oppression. We can use it too, and we're not, you know? Yeah, by and large, we're not.
Yeah, that's a fascinating thing for me, because, you know, sometimes people kind of equate, you know, radical with kind of a going back somewhere rather than going forward, and so there's no reason why technology cannot be utilised, you know, for all kinds of good things. You know, you wouldn't necessarily have to have, like, an anti technological position, would you?
No, absolutely not. Most people, I don't know, the majority of people who don't identify as anarchists who I've spoken to about this when doing street stalls and that kind of thing, they tend to make that assumption. They tend to think primitivist, you know? And that's not inevitable or, in my view, even desirable, you know? We have a lot of opportunities that we are just leaving there. And when we leave something, when we abandon something, when we fail to utilise it to its full revolutionary potential, who picks it up? The oppressors do, you know? So we're handing them all the power. We have to start taking it back. And I think that's where beginning to form media collectives, that's the first step towards taking it back and ultimately getting our voices back and drowning out these false voices they use to indoctrinate us.
Yeah, but these... You know, independent media collectives can now be linked globally because of the internet, can't they? So that is a new thing, isn't
exactly.
it?
That's a possibility that just wasn't there for us before. Mm. And
obviously, as well, you've taken part recently in an online international conference. So that will be I mean, obviously, a conference has got a particular style of presentation, and it might not be for some, but that would also be another kind of possibility for people. You know, radical conferences. Which would have people taking part from all over the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really exciting possibility, isn't it? And that there are these possibilities for connection. And those are things we didn't have before, you know? And I think what we're doing wrong, I don't know. It's always somewhat arrogant to sit there telling everybody else in the entire world what they're doing wrong, which is not what I intend to do. You know, there are some groups doing amazing stuff with independent media to empower people and connect people. And, you know, so there are plenty of people who are doing amazing stuff with the ideals, the vision presented by independent media. As part of the struggle for an anarchist world. But I just think, you know, what I see in the animal advocacy movement is wasted opportunity a lot of the time, because it's like we struggle to get ourselves into corporate media. However we end up the other end of this production process, we pour energy and resources into appealing to and dealing with corporate media. I'm just questioning the validity of that approach, because all that could have gone into independent media collective formation. I'm just thinking that, again, unfortunate to have to keep saying it, but this is a zero-sum game, you know? Unfortunately, we have to choose. There aren't a lot of us. Which is it going to be, you know? And
I agree with that, and also without a focus on the corporate media and then, in other words, the principles of independent media, it wouldn't have ever come to the equation that press coverage equals women getting their tops off, would it?
No, absolutely. That is a classic example of selling revolution, which no longer looks anything like revolution, to...
No, it's the opposite.
Yeah, exactly. Well, selling oppression disguised as revolution, ultimately, in order to, A, get into corporate media, B, come here, Zami, B, to connect with this social construct of the public, which corporate media gives us. So I'm being stood on by a greyhound. Hang on.
Okay, so we've resolved the doggy situation. They've had a good play. And let's return then to one of the themes that I know you wanted to tackle, Tina, which emerged during the workshop at the outhouse. And you wanted to talk about the issue of spokespersons, right?
Yeah, the issue of should you have a spokesperson? Should you have the role of spokesperson in independent media collectives? And this time, the feeling of the group in general was with me on this one, because we worked out that we were in agreement that the having the office of spokesperson within a group is problematic and counter-revolutionary, counter to anarchist ideals of self-representation and reclaiming our voices, because there is no one person who can speak for everybody. And after all, isn't one of the core values of anarchy, and one of the core values on which an anarchist world would be based, the notion that everybody's perspective is unique and equally valuable? And the role of spokesperson is kind of denies that. You know, it's sort of... I mean, as a hypothetical, practical example, imagine you have a group of animal advocates and with kind of an intersectional view of the struggle for justice that is veganism, like ourselves. And you imagine you were choosing a spokesperson whose role is going to be to, I don't know, write press releases, write event notices, liaise with the media, etc. There is always going to be a certain amount of perspective invisibility with that role. Because, I mean, in the average group, say you have several members of the group of different ethnicities, you have different genders, you have this complex mixture of privileges and oppressions experienced uniquely by every member of the group. Every member of that group is going to have a different take on their struggle. They all have their own unique struggles. And what an unchanging, solid role of spokesperson does is deny that and take that away. You know, so the group, the voice of the group has become condensed and thus disempowered into one group line.
So what's the answer? It's not to kind of have a rota of spokespersons, it's just for everyone to speak for themselves, isn't it?
Yeah, that would be my ideal. There is, of course, the issue that if time is limited... I mean, this is one of the basic things that always gets talked about in my experience in direct action training, is the need to have a spokesperson to liaise, I don't know, between different affinity groups, between an affinity group carrying out a direct action and the cops. You know, to have somebody to speak when it's simply practically impossible for everybody to speak because of limited time, because of the situation, if some people are locked on somewhere and somebody who isn't goes to speak to the cops. You know, those situations you need a spokesperson. So in those situations, I guess the closest to the ideal would be that you regularly change that role, that every person who finds themselves in that role is acutely aware of how their own perspective influences the way they are going to be representing the group, you know, and is mindful of and self-critical in that regard. So I think that will be closest to the ideal, but, I mean, ultimately, my ideal as an anarchist would be no spokespeople. Everybody speaks for themselves. You know, communal writing and thinking and communicating and sharing, you know. We just have this social construct in our heads of the leader. There has to be only one voice. Obviously, an interesting thing that's pointed out in David Graeber's book, Direct Action and Ethnography, is how things worked when mass actions were being planned by groups like Direct Action Network in the US. And he points out that you would have affinity groups from basically every state converging to plan enormous actions, which unfortunately is not a situation we find ourselves in ever, but he points out that what happened was that affinity groups would use consensus decision-making and discussion and organisation amongst themselves, and then they would come together in larger affinity groups. And what would happen there is that nobody would be elected representative to speak for people. You know, if somebody got up to speak, if there's only time, obviously there is only time if you have that many people in one space, there is only time for one person out of each group to speak, say. But what does not happen, you don't get an inflexible, constant role of spokesperson handed out to one person who then proceeds to articulate the group stance. The role is reflexive, it changes, and if one person has to get up to speak, it's a different person every time. I think that's a core principle, organisational principle of anarchist affinity groups. Thus, I see it as being central to the ideal of independent media collectives. It will be everybody's voices. Even in situations where physically everybody can't speak, as I say, there would be a mindfulness of the disempowering nature of rigid roles, and there would be measures taken to counteract that, as David Graeber illustrates, and as I hope I've adequately illustrated. I was really interested to see the degree of critical thinking in the group about the role of spokesperson. A lot of people seem to have strong views against this, so that was pretty great.
Okay, so to conclude then, Tina, the message I'm getting now is a fairly hopeful one, in the sense that one critique, as we've said, you know, a few minutes ago, one critique of this entire idea is that, you know, alternative is small, whereas mass is big. Hence the name. And yet now we're saying that, well, yeah, but this is the age of the internet, and so, you know, for the very first time we could possibly have something not only alternative but also big in that sense, and that's not been available to other justice movements in the past. It is now, and yet, you know, we don't see any development of it. So, you know, there is hope for the future, but also, you know, a job to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great point to conclude on, because I would like to clarify that. Again, this is an issue which kind of is relevant to my understanding of the Great Refusal, in that we are allowing an oppressive system to define and kind of delineate for us the possibilities that are available to us. We are conforming to this idea. The corporate media is so powerful, so enormous, so widespread, we cannot fight against it, we have to fight with it, we have to infiltrate it. I am saying rejection, complete, uncompromising rejection, is not only possible, it is necessary if we are ever to create an alternative, because we need the energy and resources we expend in this endless, as you put it, media dance in your workshop. We need that energy and those resources, and we need them to create something that was the dream of the Riot Girl movement, the dream of anyone who ever creates their own zine, their own pirate radio show, the dream of anyone who wants to be heard, and the message of the anarchist movement, and it is, don't let anyone steal our voices. And I think, as you point out, the technological advances that we could snatch back from the oppressors, we could turn their weapons into our weapons. Mm. And the thing
so
that's...
Now it becomes rejection, but also replacement, not just rejection, right?
Yes, well, I mean, I think what defines... One of the things that defines anarchist revolution to me is that it's creative destruction. And that's how I see rebellion against the corporate media. creative destruction. So we simultaneously destroy and we create. We simultaneously reject and we embrace. We reject the silence and the lie that is our representation in corporate media, and we embrace the possibilities that have been closed to us and forgotten by us because of corporate media. But to do that, we need to uncompromisingly reject the one in order to find the other. And I just think, to me, the reason we don't have this autonomous independent media network worldwide to empower the resistance and give a voice to the resistance and everyone within the resistance, the reason is our continued kind of belief in the corporate media, our continued hope in the corporate media.